Welcome. I guess I'm the first one on the go today. After this, I'll be down the Q&A tent. If anyone wants to go into the weeds of solar design, we'll talk about it there, because I've only got half an hour here anyway, so it's cut down from the original proposal. So, about 2017, I picked up a property in South Shropshire. I was working abroad at the time, and looking at the cost of the grid connection, I said, let's just go off-grid. So that's what we did. Lots of questions about going off-grid. You know, why do you want to do it? Well, in my case, I could add a connection. It would probably cost me about the same. But then I'd be paying bills every year, and this way I don't. So it kind of works. So I basically threw up a few obvious things here. One thing about solar is you do have to pay up front for your system, but then of course you're running costs there, so you've got to look at payback. And in my case, I had about 5,000 quid worth of connection charges to the grid and then the bills, so it made it quite an easy choice for me. So I picked up a pallet load of second-hand panels from Bimble and got them stuck on the roof and built it out from there. But all the usual stuff. There are three basic ways of going solar, as you probably know. One is the full grid connection, where you import and export as required on the grid. If you're lucky, you get paid by Octopus or somebody for your exports, and you draw it back in the winter when you don't get solar generation. It's actually a good way of going it, and it's actually quite good on carbon as well, because effectively when you're exporting, you're displacing gas generation on the grid. And when you import it back in again, they're turning up those gas generators a little bit to compensate. So you could argue that using the grid as storage at the moment is effectively nil on carbon. It'll change when they start curtailing renewables because of excess generation, but we're not quite there yet. We have transmission problems, but that's a different story. We've got semi-grid tied, which I've seen a few people do as well. Basically, they've got an off-grid system. And they have a socket that comes in from the grid, and they just plug a charger into it when batteries get low. It's actually quite a good way of doing it as well. And then of course there's a full fat off-grid, no grid connection. You just hope it doesn't rain too much in winter, because, or your generator doesn't fail when the batteries get low. So those are your basic options. Big thing about off-grid is you need to look at your power consumption. And this is just a summary. Your big things are just your living stuff, you know, your laptops, your TV, your lighting, all that sort of stuff. Water heating is a big hit, and if you're not using gas water heating or some other source of heat, you've got to think about that. Cooking, yeah, you can use a gas cooker if you want, or I do. I've got a gas cooker, but I also have an electric countertop oven and an electric induction hob and things like that, and so I try and use that most of the year, and only when the batteries really get low does the old gas turn back on at the bottle, and only to discover it's leaked over the summer. That's right. And then finally, space heating, and that's the real energy consumer in your property. My house is pretty well insulated now, but it's not wonderful. The overall U value is probably about 0.2, 0.25, which is on the better side, but even then I need a lot of energy in that January mornings to keep the house warm, especially as the wife's in Malaysia and she's tropical girl and likes it being 23 degrees. And when I'm in shorts and she's got a big heavy jumper on. So things you have to think about. Also, if you're off grid, you have to really consider what happens when it breaks. Oh, I've got no solar or something like that. So you're looking at having a generator probably stuck in a cupboard somewhere, and hopefully it still works when you drag it out. You probably want to have a log burner or something like that in the property, so to boost your heat, maybe gas or maybe oil heating. But you do have to think about multiple levels of redundancy. That's the way it goes. So how much power do you actually really need? Well, these are fairly realistic figures. I did this calculation originally, and then I've just revised it in the last week or two, and it wasn't actually very far out. So as you can see, I'll run down a few loads here. We've got about 2.5 kilowatt hours a day of just general domestic stuff. There's a couple of other fields in here which I put zeros on. The one's a heat recovery ventilation, and one's a sewage plant. Most off-grid properties, like I have to have a their own sewage treatment plant because you're not near a sewer. And almost all of them require an aerator to actually help digest the stuff that goes in it. In my case, I've got a passively driven one, which doesn't work very well, to be honest, but so I kind of wish I'd gone for an air one now. And the heat recovery ventilation, I'm using a passive ventilation system. The wind basically blows past the house and draws the air through, but again, it's not that effective. And it really, I would have, should have put a blown unit in there as well. So, water heating. It really depends how you like your showers, your baths and things like that. I've found we use about 60 litres a day in our house on average for hot water, between showers, washing up and other such activities. And I need about 2.5 kilowatt hours of heat to actually heat that water. But most, as you probably know, tanks have standing losses as well. And the normal tank with 2-inch insulation will probably lose about 2 kilowatts as well. So you've actually got about 4.5 kilowatts of energy you need to heat your hot water. It's not all bad, because at least the heat you lose in the tank warms the house. So you could argue take that off your main house heating, but in my case, I've got a small heat pump, and I actually draw the air from the living room to heat the water tank, so it all stays inside, so I don't gain anything there. Cooking, here's some fairly realistic numbers again, about 1 kilowatt hour or so for the induction hob. She likes her stews and things like that, and stir fries. We have a countertop oven, which is actually really efficient. They're about 1500 watts when they're running, but they switch on and off and take about 500 watts an hour. And I do recommend anybody who has solar gets one, because they just work. A little bit of electric kettle again, and of course the rice cooker goes in there. I've not really taken any notes of the other bits and pieces, because they can get absorbed in the big loads anyway. So you're looking at a couple of kilowatt hours in there for cooking load. But that is mostly optional as well, because in winter you can go and pull it all away and turn your gas cooker on, boil your kettle on there. Space heating. Right. I reckon I need, in middle of January when it's cold and miserable, I'm going through about 10 kilograms of firewood a day. It's about 4 to 5 kilowatt hours of energy in kilogram of firewood, but you lose about half of that with most log burners. So I'm needing about 25 kilowatt hours of heat a day when we're in the house in those months. So that's the number I take. So we add it all up, and we end up with if I can run everything in my worst month off grid, then I need about 15 kilowatt hours a day off solar, which you ain't going to get in my place. If I turn space heating off, I'm down to about 6.5, and if I really pull my head in and start cooking on the gas and everything else, then I can get away with that 4.5 kilowatts, and that's what I need to run the house. Your mileage may vary. You know, if you're in a van, you probably don't have half the bits and pieces I've got, and you can always turn a laptop or two off and turn your lights down and things. But that's quite a realistic kind of number. But then, of course, there's one people always forget about, and that's inverters also have quite a high idle load, especially the big ones. I've got a Victron Multiplus. It's an old thing. It's 5 kilowatts and takes 35 watts just sitting there looking at me. So that's nearly a kilowatt hour a day just for the availability of 5 kilowatts of power. So what I did in the initial design, I actually split my electrics in the house. I ended up with 2 consuming units. One off the 5 kilowatt, one off the 1200 watts, put the big loads on one and smaller loads on the other one. And at night, or when I'm not using it, I'll just switch off the big Victron with a wireless radio switch. And it can actually save a reasonable amount of power. And if you're desperate for those watts, then it certainly helps. It does make life complex, and I probably wouldn't do that again. I think the compromises outweigh the benefits, but it also gives you the ability that you've got 2 inverters, so if one goes bang, you haven't lost everything, and I can patch my consuming units between each other, so within the limits inverters I can still run if one's failed. But those are some fairly realistic numbers there. solar off-grid is not the same as normal domestic solar in the UK, because normal domestic solar, you're trying to produce as much as you can in a year, export what you don't use, and then try and claw it back from the grid in winter. So your optimal angle probably is about 35 degrees on your panels. You get a lot of production of salt in summer and not an awful lot in winter. Off-grid, that's a different game. You're not so much worried about how much power you generate in total. You want to get the best power in the worst month. And you don't really care about the summer too much, because your energy demands are probably lower anyway, because it's warmer. And the days are longer, so it kind of comes out in the wash. So I would like to put my panels at 60 degrees on the house, but my roof's 30 degrees, so that's where they went. So I'm losing about 25% production in December, January, compared to what I have otherwise. But I'm also losing a bit through shading from some neighbours' trees 75 metres down from me, which low sun angles mean those shadows are very, very long. And I've got a larch in the front garden, but fortunately by that time of year it's normally dropped all its needles, so it doesn't really affect things very much. There's lots of ways of predicting solar performance, and the one I like the most is actually PVGIS, which is actually an EU funded website, and there's a link at the end of this presentation to it, and it supports grid tie and off grid. So the nice thing is you can say what batteries you've got, what solar you've got, and it can tell you your location. It gives you a pretty good indication of how often you're going to have to pull that generator out. And my experience has been it's actually pretty accurate. So talking about solar panel angles, this is actually good. Yeah, you can see that. The interesting thing here is if you look at the green one, which is the where you'd normally put your panels in the UK, on a roof, and actually what I've got in my mind, you can see that if you look at month 1 and month 12, which is January and December, you're actually quite a bit below the other ones. It doesn't look a lot there, but that's 25% difference. And when you're struggling for every watt, that makes a difference. So, yeah, 60 degree panels is good on off-grid, and even verticals, not terrible. Yeah, your summer performance is pretty cruddy, but again, you don't care, you've got long days. How many panels? Well, how many can you get on the roof? That's what we did. So there's 28 panels in there. They're all second hand from a pallet of Pamble I got from Bimble about 7-8 years ago now. There's about 6.5 kilowatts worth of panels there. Because I'm struggling so much in winter, I basically shoved a few more on the carport behind, and actually more in the shed you can't see there. They're actually in really poor position, those ones at the back, but on those grey days where there's no direct sunlight and it's all just grey and diffuse light, they actually give you quite a useful uplift. So there's a thought. And yes, it is undersized, but again, it's you put up what you can. Charge controllers, you've got batteries, run 48 volts and anything more than about a kilowatt. Otherwise you've got really heavy cables and it becomes a struggle with voltage drops and wiring. I did start with a nice old Outback, which is one of those old expensive charge controllers. But the problem is I hung it on a bunch of lithium iron phosphate cells which came out of an old van. And what I found was the FM80 really didn't behave well with those cells, and that when the voltage started rising on the panels, because of the way lithium iron phosphate's voltages drift over time, it kept deciding there was another power source in the system and the batteries were charged and went away for the rest of the day. So you get the battery like half charged and the controller going to charge state and go away after the next morning, and I've got half a charge of my batteries, which really wasn't good. And I couldn't get around that with any settings I could find in it. So I ended up going to a local supplier and picked up a good old 100 amp tracer, which was actually half the price, and worked flawlessly. So there you go. Batteries. Yeah, so the original ones are these big long CALB cells. These are plastic cased, roughly 210 amp hours each. They've gone a little bit off the boil now because they're basically from 2010. They're probably down to about 80% or so, but they got a hard life before the van got wrecked and the cells became available. So I used those, but that wasn't really enough. So as soon as the prices started to drop. I picked up a 16 of the Eve type cells, compressed them, stuck them in a box, and with a active balancer, and stuck that up next to it. And so I've got about 20 kilowatts of usable energy, which is a lick on the low side, because if you're off grid, you don't want to use a generator. They say at least 5 times your daily consumption should be your usable storage. And if you want to happy using generators a lot, then have a couple of days storage. But I'm on the slightly on the lower side, and I do see that. Good old multi plus. Expensive. The Victron stuff's always expensive, but it's built like the proverbial, and it's almost indestructible. But the problem is the idle power on these things. They do take quite a bit. You can run an optimised mode, but it doesn't really make a huge difference, hence my two inverters. Monitoring. I don't have any fancy app-based management or anything like that on the system, because when I'm away and the wife's sitting there, and if it breaks down, she's got to get somebody in to fix it. And if you start talking about cloudy things and Arduinos and things like that, you can pretty well guarantee that nobody's going to be able to fix it. So the solar panels go to a charge controller, charges the batteries to a voltage and then stops. And the batteries feed into the inverters and turn the inverters on and off. And that's about the limit of how integrated our system is. I don't have any management other than the battery balancers and things like that. What I do use is these two units here. One is just a current meter, which shows me how much load is going on the system through the inverter, so I keep an eye on that. And the other thing is the Coulomb meter, which is basically Hall effect. You just clamp it on the battery cable and it counts amps in and counts amps out and has a fairly good guess of where you are. They're not that accurate, and it does drift quite by probably 10 amp hours a day. But what you do is you set it to reset to full capacity when the voltage gets to a certain point. So as soon as you get a nice sunny day and the batteries are fully charged, it resets itself and you're back on there. But you need to interpret a little bit between the two to know battery state. But I say there's nothing to break here, no apps to worry about. Of course, need a backup. I've got a little generator there. I pull it out in December, give it an oil change, buy some new petrol, and I use that. I need about 50 to 100 kilowatt hours a year, because I'm a little bit short. And at the end of January, I give whatever's left in the petrol can to my neighbour to put in his car, because I've got an electric vehicle, so it's no use to me. No. And the petrol goes off if you store it for a long time. So I'm kind of running to an end here, and I think I'm probably well ahead of time. Going off grid, it isn't really for everyone. Shropshire is a difficult place to run off grid. We get the leftover weather and rain from Wales. In the summer, we get about the same yield as we do, say, in East Anglia and Cambridge area. But in winter, it's cloudier, so we get 25% less sun when you want it. So you combine that with the poor salt angle on my solar panels. I've lost about 50% of the potential yield compared to a nice system over in Cambridgeshire, which it's not great. So there's run to there. So the wife's a city girl and I'm a country boy, and she wins. So we're about to move, and we've picked up a property near Cottenham, which is actually an agricultural barn, and it's up for renovate. In fact, at the moment I've got some guys in there pouring the floor this week. So once that's in, I'll get in there and start framing out and get the rest up. First thing that went on the site was a new solar system, which you can see there. It's about 30 panels down there, and there's a few more on the power shed you can just about make out in front of the house. In that shed are the inverters you can see in the picture there, and a stack of these Seplos Mason battery packs, which I've gone for. It's going to be. She doesn't like log burners, so we're going to have to put a heat pump in. That's what we'll do. Modern ones generally in the UK now, you don't have to worry about F-gas stuff if you get the ones with the water feed into the outdoor unit, because that way they just rock up and stick the outdoor unit there. You put the water on, there's no carbon gases we need to worry about or anything like that. So that's what's going in. We'll need about 6 kilowatt heat pump, maybe a little bit more for the water. We're still trying to run the numbers at the moment. And again, the generator will sit there just in case. And in this case, with the Seplos ones, I'm actually going to code something up and talk through the RS485 to look at battery state, and then kick a generator on at 20% and knock it off at 60%. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be an interesting project. The property itself is about 300 metres from end to end. It's quite narrow. And it would have been abandoned for 20 years, so you go digging around and you find brambles everywhere. And brambles grow gas cylinders and trailers and porter cabins. You'd be surprised what we found under some of these brambles. So one of the other projects that's actually on the site I'm doing here is actually going to be deploying a GPON system throughout the system, the site, just to try and get networking down there and run cameras and things. But there we go. At the end of this, I'll be over the Q&A tent. So if people do want to talk about how to actually safely connect solar systems, earthings in, breakers and surge protection and all the other things like that, I'll be over there. Thank you.